Today, slip sliding away. The DFA Daily to the 16th of July 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. Paul Simon's song Slip Sliding Away contains these immortal lines: "You know the nearer your destination, the more you're slip sliding away." Well, slowly the ratings agencies are getting up to speed. The latest is Fitch, who has released new property price forecasts. Australian property will be among the hardest hit by COVID-19 in 2020, with values predicted to decline by between 5 and 10% this calendar year, while normal home prices will fall in the UK, Spain and Australia. And it's all to do with the coronavirus pandemic. They say that under Fitch's new baseline forecasts, Spain suffers the most significant falls in house prices, decreasing by 8 to 12% in the full year 2020. Australian prices will decline between 5 and 10%, whereas the UK will experience a decline of 3 to 7%, assuming the avoidance of a cliff-edge Brexit at the end of the year. All six markets, they say, are suffering from contracting economies and deteriorating labour market conditions due to the pandemic. Their home price forecasts consider how far this is mitigated or magnified by country-specific factors, including policy responses, supply constraints, immigration and contrasting home price trends entering the pandemic. Extremely low immigration and fewer foreign students this year will reduce Australian home prices, which were only recently recovering from a downturn. Australia faces the challenge of almost no immigration expected for the rest of the year. High immigration has been a large driver of its home price growth in the past decade, they say. Sydney and Melbourne will also lack the large number of foreign students they usually receive each year. Lenders in Australia have confirmed that they've started checking if the borrower has received government support payments, requesting employer confirmation that the borrower is working the same hours as before the pandemic, or to see their most recent salary payment, and reducing the maximum loan-to-value ratios for high-density apartments in central business districts. These properties, they say, face the most downward price pressure from the pandemic. And under our baseline scenario, they say, we forecast home prices to largely stabilise in the UK and Spain, with a higher possibility of muted growth in Australia in 2021. And they say, in Australia, we expect an increased foreclosure activity in 2021 due to higher unemployment, even though banks will be able to offer payment deferrals on a case-by-case basis up to and including March 2021, and government stimulus packages may be extended past their scheduled expiry dates in some limited capacity. And locally, seasonally adjusted employment increased by 210,800 people between May and June, and the unemployment rate rose from 7.1% to 7.4%, according to the latest data from the ABS. The easing of COVID-19 restrictions in June saw an extra 280,000 people in the labour force, with more people in employment and more activity looking and available for work. The 210,800 increase in employment was underpinned by a large increase in part-time employment, around 249,000 people, and a further decrease in full-time employment at 38,100. The percentage of people employed in Australia increased 1% to 59.2%, up from a low of 58.2% in May. And in June, around 24% of the fall in unemployment through to May has been regained. Hours worked rose 4% in June, but remained 6.8% lower than March, and hours worked increased more for females at 5% than males at 3.3% over the month. Hours worked for females were still around 7.3% below March, compared to 6.5% for males. Unemployment increased by 69,300 people to 992,300, and around 70% of newly unemployed people in June were not in the labour force in May. The underemployment rate decreased by 1.4 percentage points to 11.7%, but remained 2.9 percentage points above March. And the underutilisation rate, which combines the unemployment and underemployment rate, fell 1% to 19.1%. After falling sharply between March and May by 4.3 points to 58.2%, the employment-to-population ratio increased by 1% in June, recovering around a quarter of the fall since March, and the participation rate saw a larger increase at 1.3 points, following a smaller decrease between March and May, down 3.3 points, reflecting the large flow of people from not in the labour force to unemployment in June. Between May and June, arts and recreation services and accommodation and food service industries again recorded relatively high movements out of employment, along with agriculture, forestry and fishing, and administration and support services, compared to other industries, of course, and to the same period last year. And in June 2020, all the states and the Australian Capital Territory recorded an increase in employment. The Northern Territory recorded a small decrease. The largest increase in employment was recorded in New South Wales, up 80,800 people, Queensland, up 52,900 people, and Victoria, up 29,500 people. And the unemployment rates increased in most states and territories except for Queensland and the Northern Territory, which decreased by 0.1 percentage points down to 7.7% and 1.8 percentage points down to 5.7%, respectively. The largest increases were 0.9% in South Australia, up to 8.8%, and the Australian Capital Territory, up to 5.1%. Participation rates increased in all states and territories except for the Northern Territories, where it dropped 2.8 points to 71.6%. And the thing I want to highlight here is the rotation, because essentially we're seeing some part-time people returning, but the loss of more full-time jobs as corporations make harder decisions and lay people off. And I think this rotation will continue for the next few months, and I expect the real unemployment rate to remain around the 13 or 14%. Of course, the ABS data is always going to understate the real position. Now, the Irish Times said recently that Europe faces a fresh banking crisis if the economic shock caused by coronavirus stretches into 2021, according to a new paper by a network of think tanks in the European Union. The European Network for Economic and Fiscal Policy Research, or Econpol, said that while banks have built up their capital bases and regulators have introduced a raft of new rules in the past decade to avoid a repeat of the 2008 crash, it would only take a fifth of loans not being repaid across EU banks to wipe out their reserves. The COVID-19 crisis is a serious test of the reforms undertaken in the wake of the 2007-2008 financial crisis, said the authors of the report, that led to reforms that were intended to prevent a systemic financial crisis, or failing that, to mitigate its consequences. The reality of systemic risk was one of the major lessons of the financial crisis, but we are now faced with the reality of a health risk that has been previously underestimated. On the scale of disasters, this health crisis is even more serious than a systemic financial crisis because of the way in which it simultaneously affects all economic activities at the global level, they added. The authors warn that if banks continue to offer supports granted to customers affected by the virus, including payment breaks and loan rescheduling, for long periods of time, capital reserves will become depleted, and a mechanism introduced in the wake of the last crash to resolve ailing banks, initially by inflicting losses on bondholders, would be severely tested. Analysts at Davy and Goodbody stockbrokers estimate that Bank of Ireland, AIB, and Permanent TSB face having to deal with more than 4 billion euros of bad loan losses stemming from the crisis over the course of 3 years. And while all three lenders, in which the state retains major stakes following bailouts during the last financial crisis, are forecast to post net losses this year as they take a hit from coronavirus, their capital levels will remain above regulatory requirements, according to the analysts. And the central bank in Ireland noticed in its latest biennial financial stability review published recently that Irish banks have higher capital levels than the European average to absorb shock losses. However, central bank governor Gabriel Machoff noted that their reserves are not infinite. And over in New Zealand, international arrivals in May were the lowest in 61 years, according to Stats New Zealand. The number of people that arrived in New Zealand in May 2020 was the lowest for any month since May 1959 because of COVID-19-related border and travel restrictions, with 5,662 arrivals in May compared with 4,700 in May 1959. Most arrivals in May 2020 were short-term travellers, made up of 2,600 New Zealand residents and 2,200 overseas visitors. Provisionally, there were 900 migrant arrivals. All these passengers include New Zealand and non-New Zealand citizens. May was the second month under full border restrictions imposed by the New Zealand government in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. In April 2020, there were just 6,300 arrivals. But more people are leaving the country than are arriving. The game was more than cancelled out by the 10,231 people who left the country in May, giving a net loss of 4,609 people. That comes on top of net losses of 25,719 in April and 58,802 in March. Most are tourists or other short-term visitors, but within the numbers, we see that more New Zealand residents are leaving the country than arriving, with 2,626 new New Zealand residents arriving in the country, while 3,057 departed, giving a net loss of 431 New Zealand residents. And that follows a drop of 578 in April. Border restrictions will continue to choke traffic, so we should expect migration patterns to be down for some long time. So those thinking that returning New Zealanders would lift demand for housing and so give a sugar hit to the property market are likely to be disappointed. Indeed, property values could be on the turn and may be heading for a 5 to 7% fall, according to the latest data from CoreLogic. In their Market Pulse report, its quarterly housing value index declined 1.5% nationally in the second quarter of this year, with larger falls seen in Auckland down 2.4% and Dunedin down 2.5%, and smaller falls recorded in Hamilton down 1.1%, Wellington 0.4% down, and Christchurch down 0.4%, while Tauranga went against the trend and was up 1.39%. That would obviously be unwelcome for any property owner, although a bonus for would-be buyers. But it would be a smaller fall than the figure of 10% seen during the global financial crisis, the report said. And next, this from Bloomberg, which helps to explain why the Aussie dollar is so high, knocking around 70 cents to the US dollar. While bets on steepening yield curves are growing in popularity, money can also be made in countries that already have one, and that's drawing investors down under. Thanks to Australia's yield curve control policy, its bonds have the steepest yield curve amongst major sovereign markets, according to 2- and 10-year note data compiled by Bloomberg. Investors can exploit that difference by borrowing at the shorter term rates and investing higher up the curve. For example, a trader could employ a carry and roll strategy, borrowing over a short time period at relatively cheaper rates and putting the proceeds into longer term higher-yielding bonds. Players then earn carry from the bond's coupon and roll from its capital appreciation as the note slides down the yield curve towards maturity. The steeper the yield curve, the greater the opportunity. What I've learnt from Australia is that a yield curve control policy targeting short-term yields can steepen the curve from time to time and make the debt attractive, said Akaya Taki, a Tokyo-based global fixed income manager at Asset Management One. Investing in a bond market where the curve is steep, like Australia, generally turns out to be a winning bet. The RBA perhaps needs to deploy a new operation. Now, the name Operation Twist was given by the mainstream media years ago due to the visual effect that the monetary policy action has expected to have on the shape of the yield curve. If you visualize a linear upward sloping yield curve, this monetary action effectively twists the end of the yield curve, hence the name Operation Twist. To put it another way, the yield curve twists when short-term yields go up and long-term interest rates drop at the same time. Operation Twist first came about in 1961 when the Federal Open Market Committee sought to strengthen the US dollar and stimulate inflows of cash into the economy. At this time, the country was still recovering from a recession following the end of the Korean War. In order to promote spending in the economy, the yield curve was flattened by selling short-term debt in the markets and using the proceeds from the sale to purchase long-term government debt. Now, it seems to me that the RBA needs to change its strategy and essentially push the long-term rates down Because at the moment, the net effect of what's going on is to push the Aussie dollar way higher than its real true value, and that's creating all sorts of issues in terms of the costs of goods, and also the fact that we don't get any benefit from the international rates. But I'm not sure they will. They seem quite fixated on messing around at the short end of the curve. Now, earlier this month, former Treasury boss David Thodey released a draft review of the New South Wales revenue system as it relates to federal funding. The review was commissioned by the New South Wales Treasurer. The centrepiece of its recommendations was an increase in the GST. Australia has high income taxes compared to the OECD average, but a relatively low GST rate. However, indirect taxes, excluding GST, exceed those of comparable countries on average, according to those OECD figures. But Remy Davison from Monash University argues that the GST is a lazy, regressive, blunt instrument that operates as a substitute for taxation reform across the spectrum instead of reforming vested interests targeting financial and property speculation, as well as resources profits. The GST base could be expanded to hit, say, basic food or private school education or something else. And GST hikes allow governments to eschew carefully targeted tax incentives directed at future key employment sectors, such as green jobs, carbon pricing, digital economy and manufacturing, and innovation R&D. So he suggests some alternatives. First, we should be taxing the digital economy. The digital economy has proven notoriously difficult to tax. The rise of the gig economy is also hard to police. Workers may fall below the GST reporting thresholds. The informal or shadow economy leads to regulatory avoidance, while workers use cash and cryptocurrencies. Unregulated digital services allow international labour to displace domestic workers across borders. I could pay offshore Indian graduates to grade papers, he says, but I don't. The EU shadow economy is valued at 2.4 trillion euros, while the global informal economy is estimated at nearly 10 trillion US dollars. That's bigger than China's GDP. The French government has sought to deal with both corporate tax evasion and the digital economy by imposing a 3% tax on revenues. In 2020, Paris postponed the tax as Trump threatened tariffs on French exports due to allegations of harm to the US tech sector. Verdict, he says, it's complicated. Second, you could create sovereign wealth funds. Kevin Rudd tried and failed to implement a resource super profits tax. An aggressive campaign waged by the resources industry, 83% foreign owned, cost Rudd his job. The Gillard government implemented the tepid mining resources rent tax, which collected virtually no revenue until it was repealed by the Abbott government. In contrast, the UK introduced a petroleum super profits tax in 1975 until the Cameron-Clegg government abandoned the tax in 2016. For 40 years, North Sea oil revenues funded everything from the NHS to mortgage tax relief. The UK deserves plaudits for reducing VAT to zero under COVID-19 for e-books and online journals. It also charges no VAT on food except for junk foods and alcohol. Sensibly, Norway has locked oil and gas tax revenue into a sovereign wealth fund worth more than $1 trillion. The Australian state and federal governments should be doing precisely this with taxes on resources, super profits, including iron ore, coal and gas. Third, he says, there should be a financial transaction levy. If you're an investor on the domestic or foreign exchanges, you pay GST to your broker, but you can claim it back as an expense. Your broker pays zero GST on every trade. The ASX already collects a small levy on transactions, but this could easily be extended to a Tobin tax, as the Australia Institute has argued, without imposing a significant burden on business. And then there's, of course, the question of land taxes or stamp duty. State governments saw the writing on the wall in 2018-19 when property prices slumped despite a pre-COVID recovery. Inflated real estate prices meant Victoria alone expected state coffers to swell by $6 billion annually. A substitute land tax would require an estimated $4,000 impost on every household. Inevitably, the states will transition to land taxes to avoid the peaks and troughs of real estate booms and busts. Moreover, land tax guarantees revenue in perpetuity. But the longer the national cabinet delays reforms to the tax revenue base, the longer states will depend upon duties, licensing fees and royalties. Impoverished state revenues from a shrinking GST cake in a receded post-COVID economy will place further financial pressure on essential services such as health, social services and education. And as for negative gearing and the capital gains concession, neither major party wants to revisit this given the ALP's reforms have twice been rejected in federal elections. And he concludes that there is no such thing as a neutral tax policy. Revenue-neutral tax changes, yes, but in the post-COVID environment, governments will be left with an unpalatable choice between either increasing income taxes or boosting less conspicuous indirect taxes to fill budget black holes. Governments will inevitably choose the latter as consumption taxes like GST are less easily understood, apply across the board and slug everyone from students and pensioners to tourists and the homeless, except corporations and sole traders that merely act as GST tax intermediaries. Every single country, he said, bar Australia, that has introduced a GST or VAT has increased the rate. Rates rose appreciably after 2008. In 2010, New Zealand raised its GST from 12.5% to 15%. Australia's GST rate will exceed 10% by 2030, he says, irrespective of the federal government's protestations to the contrary. With higher unemployment combined with lower corporate and income tax revenues, indirect tax increases are a mathematical certainty. The moral? Never stand between a state treasurer and a swag of GST revenue. So, standing back and putting all that together, you can see that this further set of data again suggests that we are indeed slip-sliding away. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.